Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, you're out of work, you're looking for a job, you find one you think you're qualified to do, and then your potential boss says, no, you're not, because you're unemployed. One advocacy group says it's found evidence that some employers are refusing even to consider unemployed people for available jobs. We'll hear from them and a lawyer who represents employers in a few minutes. That's our weekly Money Coach conversation. But first, after 4.5 months, the commissioner of the NFL and the head of the Players Association are finally talking football, not lockout. On Tuesday, representatives of the players voted to accept a 10-year agreement to end the lockout that started in March. It was the longest work stoppage in NFL history. Demora Smith is the executive director of the NFL Players Association, and he's with us now to talk about the new deal. Thank you so much for joining us, Mr. Smith, and congratulations.
Thank you very much, and we're thrilled for our fans and thrilled for our players.
Well, obviously, in most compromises, you know, each side has to give something. So what are you most gratified to get in the new agreement, and what are you sorriest to give up?
Any negotiation is, at the end, a good compromise between the parties. So for the players in the National Football League, we were able to achieve certainty when it comes to the amount of revenue that will be used to compensate players. We made historic changes in the work rules to keep the game safer going forward. And finally, we made a substantial stride together with the National Football League in taking care of former players and supplementing their pensions with a new creation of a funded benefit of $610 million over the next 10 years. So I'm very proud of our players, certainly happy with the deal between the owners and the players. There's another step to go, but we're moving in the positive direction.
We can talk about that in a minute, but what are you sorriest to give up?
Well, any negotiation, you argue over things that generally come down to economic terms. I think if it's a good deal, both sides walk away a little bit unhappy with not getting everything they want. Certainly the players were interested in more compensation. The trade for that, of course, was certainty for the revenue share for the first time in history. And certainly for the first time in history, contracts which are guaranteed against injury. That part was a significant win by the players and a way to make sure that our players are taken care of going forward.
Vikings linebacker Ben Lieber, one of the 10 plaintiffs, said that this will probably turn out to be one of the best deals in the history of sports. And that's a far cry from what he and some of the other players were saying before the talks broke off in March, when he called the owner's last offer probably the worst deal in sports history. So what turned things around?
Well, two things, I think. The players certainly stood together when many people thought that the players would become fractious. Two, I think the management and NFL owners, once they got the opportunity to sit face-to-face with players and really dive into the issues, there was certainly a will to get football going again. So I think the combination of those two things resulted in a fair and balanced deal between the both of us.
What about the question of the retired players and how they are to be treated? I mean, one of the things that you've talked about before is that this is a sport with a 100% injury rate.
Absolutely.
And this is one of the issues that has surfaced in recent years that was almost never talked about in the past, which is the health effects that many players are experiencing long after their playing years have ended. What does this deal do for them?
Well, this deal is a continuation, I believe, of the focus of the players since March of 2009 to step up to the plate and to take these issues directly and aggressively. And Michelle, you remember when you and I were talking about the manner in which concussions were treated in the National Football League and how the players took a very aggressive stance on changing the way concussions are managed and dealt with. In less than basically 15 months, you saw almost a sea change in the way concussions were being managed and treated in the National Football League and really throughout football. So the next step became, what can we do with a lasting agreement that for the first time in history has teams contributing to the pensions of former players?
We're speaking with the head of the NFL Players Union, Demora Smith. We're talking about the recently concluded agreement that will allow the pro football season to proceed, you know, on schedule. A training camp, as I understand it, starts today. What have most of the players been doing during the lockout?
Well, you saw many of them continue to work out on their own. These young men are not only tremendous athletes, they recognize the necessity of maintaining their physical condition. I think one byproduct of the lockout has been an extended period of time for players to have off for rest and recovery. One of the things that we achieved in this new agreement is that players will have a longer amount of time off. I tried to capture it, at least conceptually, as something called spring semester.
I was going to say, how does that work since the number of regular season games remains the same, right? So how does that work?
They remain the same, but veterans will now not report to camp until at the earliest the third week in April. Many of our players were coming back to at least some sort of mini camp or organized team activity as early as the beginning of March. So it was important not only from a health and safety standpoint to push to a system where there was more time for rest and recovery, but many of our young men leave college, enter into the business of football, not having completed their college degree. We have now provided an opportunity and time for many of our men to go back to school and capture a semester where they can finish their degree, because I want every one of them preparing for the day that football will end.
How do you think the fans should view all this? And on the one hand, it's kind of a wash. Nothing was lost. The regular season, I assume, is going to start on schedule, right?
Absolutely.
And I assume you think that the young men will be ready, the young men and the not-so-young men will be ready. But, you know, the rest of the country is really suffering right now.
Yes.
And this is the country's most popular sport. And I think it's a lot hard for some people to understand how it is that you guys couldn't come to agreement over $9 billion in revenue over 4.5 months. How should fans think about this period?
From the fan standpoint, I think that they should be proud of the players and the way that they stood together, because it was important not only to take care of rookie contracts, it was important for the players to take care of former players. For a guy who grew up in this area, I'm proud that Redskins like Vonnie Holiday made a decision to take care of the pensions for guys like Sam Huff.
Now, remember, as part of this process, the union decertified itself.
Right.
Are there issues still to be negotiated?
Absolutely. First step is we will be meeting with all of our teams over the next 4 days, 5 days, to see if they want to reconstitute as a union. If that vote is yes, we then engage with the National Football League to discuss only those issues that we could do as a union representing the players. So issues like pension benefits, other benefits, discipline, grievances, all of those things, other health and safety issues, those are issues that need to be joined and need to be resolved before August 4th, when we would vote to ratify the entire CBA.
And finally, do you have any advice for the president and the Congress, who seem to be having some trouble coming to agreement over some financial issues, which also have rather large consequence for the country? Do you have any advice for them?
Yeah, Michelle, you do a great job of absolutely putting me on the spot. You know, look, I think it's important for the country that everybody remain reasonable and try to rectify the issues between them. And that's what we did as players. I know that's what Roger and the owners did. We all spent a tremendous amount of time together over the last few months trying to resolve forceful positions between us, let's say. And we did. And I think that's a great thing for football, certainly a great thing for the country.
Well, now that you have some free time, perhaps you will volunteer your services?
Absolutely not.
Demaurus Smith is the head of the NFL Players Union. He was nice enough to talk to us from his offices in Washington, D.C. Mr. Smith, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle. Thank you.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. At the U.S. Capitol, phone lines and inboxes are filled up with messages from constituents. There has been overwhelming response about the debt ceiling after speeches last night by both President Obama and Republican House Speaker John Boehner. The president also explicitly called for people to contact their members of Congress.
In a moment, we'll hear from the White House, from one of the president's top economic advisors. First, all eyes in Washington are on the House. Speaker Boehner has pledged to pass his own plan to cut spending and raise the debt ceiling. The question is, can it pass? NPR's Andrew Seabrook reports.
Remember last Friday when House Speaker John Boehner abandoned talks with the president? Well, that may have angered some people, but it did a great thing for Boehner. It brought him praise and applause and new clout within his own party. Standing up to the president ended a kind of whisper campaign that had been dividing rank-and-file Republicans, and even Tea Party groups who've been openly critical of the speaker are supporting him. The local Tea Party group in Boehner's own district in Ohio is rallying for him. Now, there are still serious divisions among members of the House Republican Conference. Congressman Jim Jordan heads a group of the most conservative members of the House. Today, he seemed to be almost rooting for Boehner's debt ceiling plan to fail.
I am confident, as of this morning, that there were not 218 Republicans in support of the plan.
Jordan and a handful of other Republicans say they will not vote for any increase in the country's credit limit unless both chambers pass an amendment to the U.S. Constitution, one that would force the government to balance its budget every year. Many freshman Republicans especially are vehemently opposed to raising the debt limit, and they speak of President Obama not so much as a political opponent, but as their enemy. South Carolina's Jeff Duncan said Republicans will fight this battle with the president to the end. Listen to Duncan paraphrase from a speech Winston Churchill gave in 1940 in defiance of the Nazis.
We're going to fight you on the beaches. We're going to fight you at the sea. We're going to fight you in the air to make structural changes to the way this place, known as Washington, D.C., operates.
The fact that opposition to the speaker's plan within his own party has gone from a whisper campaign to a public hue and cry may actually be a good sign for Boehner. Washington is sometimes upside-down world, where movements for or against a particular bill gather power silently, and it's only when a lawmaker senses he's losing that he takes his argument to the press. For his part, Speaker Boehner, of course, thinks he can get his bill through the House.
We're going to have some work to do to get it passed, but I think we can do it.
And the Republican whip, Kevin McCarthy, the guy in charge of counting GOP votes, had this to say today.
This is what the American people have been asking for. We look forward to moving this bill off the floor of the House, onto the Senate, and to the president's desk.
Now, things are changing by the minute. Right now, Republican leaders are scrambling to make deeper cuts after hearing from the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office that the bill wouldn't cut as much as they wanted. That puts off the vote by a day. But for now, it appears Boehner has successfully maneuvered the politics of this into a better place for him. Instead of shattering Republican unity by negotiating with Democrats, Boehner has turned the outcome of his bill into a kind of anti-Obama vote. That amps up the pressure on his members to pass it when it comes to the House floor Thursday. Andrea Seabrook, NPR News, Washington.
Some kids in Baltimore, Maryland fight a daily battle against poverty, homelessness, and a drug epidemic that's ravaged their neighborhoods. Many kids miss a lot of school and eventually just stop going. City officials are trying to prevent that by reaching out to kids early and holding their parents accountable. NPR's Claudio Sanchez has the story, which is part of our series this week looking at school dropouts.
When Danny Lamont Jones showed up at Tench Tillman Middle School in East Baltimore, he was living only a few blocks away in a homeless shelter where I first met him.
I think I was like 12 when I first came here. Living in a shelter, like, with people I don't know, everything was just going downhill, and I ain't know what to do.
Danny had missed the entire sixth grade and most of seventh grade. He barely knew how to read.
I was lost. I was kind of lost because I'd been out of school for so long. I was young, and I had a crazy mind, and then, you know what I'm saying?
That craziness, says Danny, was due in part to his mother.
My name is Bernice Jones. I'm 56. I have 14 youngins, 38 grandkids, one great-grandchild.
Jobless, with a 10th grade education, Mrs. Jones relies entirely on public assistance. She's an alcoholic and suffers from debilitating anxiety attacks.
Now I got myself in a situation I couldn't handle too much of anything, so I didn't know what to do. I just put the kids here and there, and right now my son is doing pretty good.
Danny says things aren't really okay, like his mom says. His 13 brothers and sisters are scattered. Two are in jail. Some live with relatives. The oldest are on their own and rarely have contact with Danny. As for his father...
Last time I talked to him, he told me forget he was my father, and it hurt me. I kind of miss him, but I don't like him at all.
Growing up, Danny says he felt like he was all alone. Local organizations estimate that there are about 1,300 children like Danny in Baltimore. On their own, sometimes homeless, fatherless, or with a sick, troubled parent. Most of these kids are in and out of school.
We know Danny. We've been to that shelter where Danny was, and it's the relationship with the shelter that's keeping Danny alive and keeping him out of gangs.
J.L. Yan is the principal at Tense Tillman. She says Danny raised lots of red flags not long after he enrolled as an eighth grader at her school. He was quiet, struggling academically, and he didn't show up very often. Yan says if a child misses anywhere from 20 to 50 days of school a year, chances are that child is going to drop out.
In communities like East Baltimore, every child in your class is at risk. You don't know what they had to go through to come to school every day. You have to keep, you know, encouraging them and checking on them. And that's the toughest thing, I think, for some of our kids like Danny.
These children face huge odds, says James P. Comer of Yale University. He's a leading expert on child development and high poverty schools like those in East Baltimore.
If the school can compensate for the disruptive or troublesome culture that the child comes out of, the school can create a culture that can really overcome problems that children have and even help families get on their feet.
Comer says it's incredibly hard work, expensive, and often controversial. Baltimore, for example, has adopted a zero-tolerance policy in dealing with kids who miss school. J.L. Yan says the district can fine parents $50 or put them in jail if their kids miss 20 or more days of school.
That may be a last resort to really send that message home. It is illegal to keep your child out of school.
The school district cited over 400 parents this school year. The district's key strategy, though, has been placing teams of psychologists and counselors in schools like Tense Tillman to identify the kids who are most at risk of dropping out. Baltimore has gotten high marks and lots of news coverage for reducing both the dropout rate and truancy rate by half in just 3 years. But if you count the number of kids who start ninth grade every year and the number that graduate 4 years later, the city's dropout rate is still pretty high, at least 45% by some estimates. And that hasn't done much for Baltimore's collective angst about kids like Danny.
In my head, I think I have to prove a point that I'm not scared of anyone.
These days, Danny says he doesn't feel so alone. His mom has cut way back on her drinking. She's found an apartment she can afford, so Danny has moved in with her and out of the shelter on Rose Street. Danny is supposed to start 10th grade next fall. I ask him, are you going to stay in school and get your diploma?
I actually don't know. I don't know. I don't want to be an oddball. I don't want to be different enough, but I don't know.
And so, for all their efforts, no one who's intervened in this 15-year-old's life, not his principal, Miss Yan, his teachers, or the people at the shelter who took him off the streets, no one can say with any degree of confidence that Danny is going to make it. This uncertainty is what makes solving the dropout crisis so elusive. Claudio Sanchez, NPR News.
Now, as part of our series this week, we're also going to look at the financial struggles that dropouts face as adults decades after they quit school.
I'd go to a different job, and there were several jobs, good-paying jobs I could have had, but because I didn't have a high school diploma, they wouldn't even consider me.
Looking back on a long-ago decision to quit school, we'll hear that tomorrow. NPR's business news starts with an IPO for Dunkin' Donuts. All right, Dunkin' Donuts goes public today, part of the chain's plan to sell more donuts and coffee in more parts of the country. Kurt Nickisch has more from member station WBUR in Boston.
Dunkin' Donuts stores in New York City and Boston are as common as bad drivers here.
They serve a very good quality coffee in a very unpretentious way.
That's consultant Darren Tristano from the firm Technomic. He says people think of Dunkin' as a donut chain, but it actually makes most of its money selling coffee and other drinks. That makes Seattle-based Starbucks Dunkin's main competitor.
I don't like Starbucks.
That's loyal Dunkin' customer Joe Fine sipping coffee at one of the donut shops in Boston. No Wi-Fi in the place, no hip music either, but Fine doesn't care.
Doesn't have a lot of atmosphere, but I normally don't sit in one. I normally get it to go.
Dunkin' wants to take its basic blue-collar style to more parts of the country. Just listen to its TV commercials.
Anyone can be a hero with a new Captain America Cherry Coulada from Dunkin'. Get yours for a limited time only. America runs on Dunkin'.
Well, not yet. Right now, Dunkin' has just one store for every million people in the western part of the U.S. But with money from its IPO, Dunkin' plans to invest more in marketing and new franchises. For NPR News, I'm Kurt Nikisch in Boston.